As we work for peace, we cannot lose sight of Russia's increasingly brutal attacks against Ukraine. Russia is systematically targeting civilian infrastructure, depriving Ukrainians of heat and light at the start of winter. Russia is not alone in this war, as China continues to be its decisive enabler, and Iran and North Korea also provide support. Since the earliest days of Russia's full-scale invasion, allies have shown unwavering commitment to Ukraine. In recent months, European and Canadian allies have provided billions of dollars of essential U.S. equipment to Ukraine through Pearl. This support is an important part of our ongoing efforts to ensure Ukraine has what it needs to defend today and deter future aggression.
Who in the hell is Rutte? Where does he come from? I don't wish to be too delicate in this sense, but he's from the Netherlands. How many people live in the Netherlands? Well, if I were running the show, I would say, how many forces can the Dutch put into the field? How many forces can the Norwegians put in the field? Remember Stoltenberg from Norway, making all these utterly ridiculous and stupid remarks, 90% of which were lies. The same thing with Rutte. You know, anybody who is a real leader in the West would turn to these people and say, shut up and sit down. We, the United States, Washington, have no interest whatsoever in continuing this destructive and pointless war with Russia. So we're not interested in what you have to say any longer. You know, the Germans understood this for years. The Russians have always understood it. At some point, you need to say, put up or shut up. During World War II, when we had 63 divisions in France, the British, including the Canadians, had 19. And the thing that no one on the Soviet side could never understand was why Eisenhower paid any attention whatsoever to what Montgomery and Churchill had to say. They had no skin in the game compared with us. 63 divisions versus 19. Well, you have a similar situation today in Europe. What is your military power? How many forces have you got? The answer to those things is not much, if anything, worthy of attention. So someone needs to tell these people, shut up, sit down, here's the answer. That is what President Trump should do. But he's not doing it. He's not doing it. Now, we can speculate on his donors, the people that really control him, and I think that Witkoff and Kushner are very representative of those donors and their desire to keep this war going with Russia. But they're not legally, legitimately in charge. Hell, they don't even hold appointments in the administration. They're not part of the State Department. And if Trump and Rubio can't come to an agreement, then he should fire Rubio and put somebody else over there that understands what the hell's at stake. It is our relationship with Russia that counts. Our relationship. The Germans understand their relationship counts. Germany, as soon as this nonsense finally ends, and I don't think it's going to last too much longer, the Germans are going to move out of NATO. They're going to leave the EU. That's where we're headed. What happens when the Germans leave NATO and the EU? Quick guess, 2-second answer, nothing. It's finished. It's over. It's irrelevant. Okay? That's where we're headed. Donald Trump can either help manage this and control it and drive it in a positive direction, or he can do what he's doing right now. Worry about the optical illusion that he wants to create. Send Witkoff and Kushner over there to help him create good optics for him. His optics don't matter. Here's a big secret that Donald Trump needs to figure out. No one in the United States gives a damn. We're not interested in what these people are doing. Most people on the streets of Kansas City or Seattle, Washington, don't even know this thing called NATO. If you tell them we've got troops over there, they'll say, really, where? Where's that? We haven't even talked about Ukraine. Ask people about Ukraine. And what are they going to say? I don't know. Well, I don't know. Maybe we need to be there. I mean, we are a planet unto ourselves. President Trump knows that. He needs to act on it. He needs to put an end to all of this nonsense. Forget the optical illusions.
Why do you suppose that might be? I mean, if you could just speculate a little bit, is it that he himself is just not willing to buck up? Because in other things, he doesn't hesitate to take really controversial statements and not care about what people think. Is it somehow that he's concerned, I don't know, with handlers, as you call it, or is it because he has surrounded himself only with yes men who won't tell him that that's what he should do? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think all of the above, but like most presidents, and there are very, very few exceptions in our history, he's comfortable on the domestic scene, even though he engages his mouth before his brain is fully engaged. He does understand the domestic environment. He may not understand just how hard things are on the average American right now. I don't think he does. And I think people are pumping sunshine into an orifice for him to make him feel good about the economy, because it's not good. And the financial system is very fragile. But he's more comfortable talking about those things. He knows right from wrong. He's willing to address it now. Is he doing anything about it? That's another matter. I mean, how many people have we arrested up in Chicago that were responsible for trying to obstruct ICE, that were directly challenging federal authority in an area where the federal law is clear and unambiguous? None. So he really hasn't acted decisively there, and that's unfortunate. But he does understand it. But when you move beyond the borders of the United States, especially into Europe, I don't think he does. And I think he sees foreign policy the way many presidents do. It offers one of two possibilities. One is to make yourself look good, grand, and powerful, or two, to have your rear end handed to you. Okay. Vietnam handed the rear end to LBJ. And even Nixon, who ultimately extricates this, takes too long to do it and is destroyed as a result on the way out. So the lesson for most presidents ought to be, if you don't have to involve us overseas, don't do it. He hasn't learned that lesson.
Doug, that's one of the ironies here, because he got into office on that premise, because people did get that, especially in the Obama's Iraq stuff and Afghanistan and all these years that we just wasted there, et cetera. He tapped into that. Did he forget that?
I don't think he forgot it. I just don't know that he really believed it to begin with. I think his instincts told him exactly what you just said, but surround yourself with the kinds of people who are there right now. And it's very seductive to believe that somehow or another you can make something good out of something bad. You know, look, he waited and waited and waited to get us out of Afghanistan. I know that President Trump in July of 2017 thought we should get completely out of Afghanistan. He was right. What did he do? He didn't. Because he was too easily seduced by the promise of success on the one hand, and on the other, he didn't feel comfortable taking that position and standing his ground, because he really didn't know much about it. What do you do when someone doesn't know much about the subject? You know, Lyndon Johnson in the basement of the White House had a replica of Khe Sanh created, showing where all the defending Marine forces were, and where all the North Vietnamese were. He was trying to sort through it, understand it, manage it. How? He didn't know what he was looking at. It could have been, under the Christmas tree, as far as LBJ was concerned. He didn't know anything about that. So part of the problem is that we tend to elect presidents who are good political figures. They understand how to cultivate the public. They understand how to say the right things. They ultimately understand how to get elected. But when it comes to governing, that's a different matter. Sometimes they're okay on the domestic side. Many times they're not. But when it comes to foreign and defense policy and the economy, they fail miserably.
And I wonder if I could just kind of tap into something you said here, because a lot of our viewers may not know, some may, but when you talk about how President Trump wanted to get out of Afghanistan earlier, it's not academic or something that you read, but something that you live, because when you worked with the first Trump administration, you actually helped craft an actual plan to get us out of Afghanistan.
If I can interrupt briefly, though, sure. The reason I know about July 2017, and you could bring on Steve Bannon, because it was Steve Bannon in the West Wing of the White House that told me that point blank. And he said at the end of the day, there were only two people in that whole room, because you had something like 12 people many of whom were four stars, and others were leading political figures. But there were two people that agreed with the president. One was Steve Bannon, the other was Peter Navarro. We need to get out. And you see, I think President Trump forgets that one man with courage makes a majority. That's why we have a president. He hasn't come through for us.
And so
confronted majority, when he was confronted with a majority opposing him, which even included this man Kelly that came in to be his chief of staff, he buckled.
Well, see, and that's actually what I wanted you to quantify for us, because you were brought into the administration late to craft a plan that would have got us out before Trump left office. He wouldn't have pushed it off until May, I think, of 2021, but would have had it before he left office. And you had president signed an order. But what happened to make that unhappen?
Well, when he ran into opposition from the Hill, from the Senate, the House, as well as from the Joint Chiefs, especially Milley, his own temporary Secretary of Defense, and at the time, the Chief of Staff to the Acting Secretary of Defense was Kash Patel, they all said, "Oh, no, Mr. President, we can't just leave like that. No, we can't do that." And, of course, everyone that I spoke to, and these were people that, like you, had served over in Afghanistan more than one tour, they were knowledgeable, and they said, if you're going to go, this is a great time to go. Let's get out in the winter. And I went through them. I said, well, we're going to drive some things out. He said, well, you may or may not be able to drive everything out, but you can still fly out, and you can still get out. And there are ways to do it. And so I sat down with people. Now, the ways to do it, that part went in the trash can because nobody in the White House was really interested in that. What they were interested in was ordering us out. They did that. The executive order was drafted. It was signed by President Trump, and people were hanging out of the windows of the executive office building cheering and when the order was sent over to the White House for signature. So could he have done that? Yeah, I think he could have done that. Would that have meant that people in the Senate and the House might have tried to pass legislation blocking him? Maybe. Remember, you don't have very many brave people in Washington. People don't like to do things for which they could be held personally accountable. So given the opportunity to actually take a decisive stand, most will say, no thanks. Let the president go. And if the president's successful, they'll all cheer. And if he's not successful, then they'll hang him politically as quickly as possible.
And it's just so ironic and perverse that all the things that you had set up and the plans that you had and all of the fears that people were opposing that by saying all these bad things would happen. The bad things didn't happen after we left. It was just crickets to this day. And yet we would have saved a lot of American lives who ended up being killed because of the chaos that followed in the way it was handled under the Biden administration, which was even worse than what Trump had done. But that's just an example of exactly what you're talking about, the absence of courage and principled decision do the right thing.
Remember, keep in mind that the purpose of going into Afghanistan was always to eliminate bin Laden and 300 or 400 of his closest friends. And that was made very clear to Tommy Franks, and that General Tommy Franks made that clear to his subordinates. That's what we're going in to do. That's it. Why didn't that happen? Well, you've got to go back and you've got to look at Paul Wolfowitz, who is really running the show in the Pentagon. You've got to go back to Scooter Libby working with Cheney and Wolfowitz to persuade people that we needed to stay in Afghanistan. And so by the time you get troops and forces, very few of them, but you still got them on the ground in Afghanistan, the focus shifted away from what do we do to eliminate bin Laden, who now is sitting in Pakistan with his little crowd. It became, we've got to focus on Afghanistan. And there were some people, and I knew them, some of them were classmates of mine, who raised their hands and said, you know, we really don't want to do that. We're going to end up in a war in Afghanistan against the Afghan people. We didn't come here for that. We need to stay out of that. We don't want to engage in what, at the time, the 18th Airborne Corps commander, who had never been anywhere in his life but Fort Bragg, I think his name was McNeil, he kept saying, well, we have to launch search and destroy missions inside Afghanistan. Oh, my God. To do what? And people said, that'll just enrage the population. This will become a nightmare. But that was very convenient at the time for the political leadership in Washington. It had gotten to W and convinced him, well, this is a sideshow anyway, boss. We just need to keep the lid on there and we'll go to Iraq next. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And in retrospect, I'm sure several historians will dissect this and you'll eventually get something reasonably close to the truth. And they'll all say, how could anyone have ever reached these conclusions?
Well, yeah. No question about it. And speaking of what historians will do looking back, one of the other things I think on this current crisis or war, conflict in Russia and Ukraine is going to be how could the West and Ukraine continue to pretend like they could win it or even push off an eventual Russian victory when the evidence was so clear that they couldn't? And somebody who's looking back at that from the position of knowledge right now is also Vladimir Putin. This is what he said yesterday when musing about how in the world can the Ukraine and the European side keep supporting this at the cost of so much Ukrainian blood.
Did I understand correctly? Yes, that the enemy was trying to seal off Krasnomorsk at any cost, absolutely at any cost. Yes, with absolutely no regard for losses and, in my opinion, realizing that this was no longer possible, they were still throwing in more and more units, practically to the slaughter, without any exaggeration. If we keep in mind that, well, except for the nationalist battalions, not the Nazi battalions, that the Ukrainian armed forces are essentially a worker peasant army, then they don't feel sorry for the common soldier. Well, what I just said is true. It is true, yes, the nationalist battalions are not participating, they are refusing this mission. Here, the newly conscripted, the mobilized, are carrying out this task. You can tell from them, they were recently conscripted. These people are untrained. They're simply marching toward the slaughter in the direction of Krasnomorsk. They're dying there by the dozens and hundreds.
And by the way, Krasnomorsk, for our viewers, that's the Russian term that they use for Pokrovsk. But he's saying that the Ukraine side is just throwing these troops just into a garbage bag, if maybe even worse than a meat grinder, while keeping their better troops, the Azov Corps, etc., out of the fray. Because from what I've read from other sources, they refused to go into these places where they knew they were going to lose. But yet the Ukrainian authorities kept sending these guys into the meat grinder. What do you make of that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in Washington, the narrative is what counts, not the truth. The narrative is what you are rewarded for repeating. The narrative is an opportunity to enrich yourself and benefit from donors. The truth is irrelevant. And I don't think that President Putin really understands that. So many of the people that are talking, you know, I was reading about members of the Senate who were insisting that Witkoff, for instance, should be considered a traitor to the United States for actually going to Moscow to negotiate, which is an absurd statement. I mean, I'm not a fan of how this president and his makeshift cabinet works, but the notion the man's a traitor because he's trying to help negotiate some deal that'll make Trump look good doesn't make him a traitor. That's nonsense. But we have to understand there's a narrative, and that's the narrative that everybody keeps repeating, and they will repeat it until they can't, and then they'll shut up and they'll walk away and they'll try to hide from the narrative. Remember, we were always winning in Vietnam. We were winning and winning and winning and killing more and more and more, and then suddenly we weren't and we left. So you have a similar phenomenon. The other thing is, Putin is the one man in this drama who ends up coming across as a true humanitarian because he actually gives a damn about the millions of Orthodox Christian Slavs who are being murdered pointlessly in Ukraine. That's a very noble thing. I happen to agree with him. I am not pleased at all with what has happened to Ukraine. I don't see any benefit to Europe or to anyone in the world to see these deaths, or for that matter, the deaths of Russians. It doesn't help us. It doesn't make us strong or great. We don't benefit. The average American doesn't benefit. Then the final point is this. If you go back and look at the famous Battle of New Orleans that elevated Andrew Jackson as a equivalent of what we would call a National Guard general in those days to national hero status, you go and look at the place that was set up as a defense. you know, you were, the defense was brilliantly constructed, and the British stupidly attacked in the wrong place, and they ended up attacking not in these beautiful lines that you see in Hollywood, but holding their muskets over their heads because they were up to their chins in swamp water, trying to reach the 20-foot banks behind which sat the Americans. Well, of course the Americans won at very low cost, and the British were slaughtered, and it was a dumb idea. It should never have happened that way. Nobody reconnoitered. Nobody thought it through. They went the wrong way. They moved into a swamp, and the rest is history. Well, that's kind of what you've seen happen in eastern Ukraine with the Russians. The Russians built these impregnable defenses, and now these defenses have actually moved forward, always at a very deliberate and cautious pace to ensure that the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance platforms were in place, that all the strike weapons, artillery, rocket artillery, mortars, everything were all in place, annihilating whatever attacked them. In other words, move forward, stop, be attacked, move forward, stop, be attacked. It's been a slaughterhouse. It was a very intelligent way to do business. But it's not what we expected, because it's not what we thought they would do, because we were convinced that the Russians wanted to overrun all of Ukraine, which was never the case. They still don't.